Okay, if you'll ready your exam booklets and keypads, we'll move on to exam number three. Which will cover the morning's material. Okay, if I could have the first question, please. Compared to SPECT myocardial perfusion imaging, PET MPI is a superior test to detect exercise-induced ischemia, B, has a higher overall diagnostic accuracy to detect CAD, C, has worse attenuation correction, D, is a less expensive test. Okay, and the correct answer is B, and I think with that kind of statistics, we can move on to the next question. Which of the following is true regarding the appropriate use criteria? A, appropriate use criteria are based solely on expert opinion. B, AUC categorize clinical scenarios irrespective of clinical guidelines. AUC assume that a designation of uncertain is grounds for non-reimbursement. D, an inappropriate rate is assumed not to be zero. And E, AUC are strictly followed by all radiology benefits managers. And the correct answer is D.
Just minor comments. AUC are based on expert opinion in the rare forms. Ideally, it should be literature based. And then also, they do try to follow clinical guidelines. So those are the two outliers.
Next question. The list of PET perfusion radiotracers arranged in order of increasing half-life are A, rubidium 82, nitrogen 13 ammonia, F18 FDG, and O15 water. B, rubidium, water, ammonia, FDG. C, FDG, ammonia, water, rubidium. And D, water, FDG, rubidium, ammonia. Sounds like the kitchen cabinet. And the correct answer is B. Still, most of you got that? Any comment?
Yeah, that's great. I think most of you got it right. Rubidium is the shortest half-life tracer, 76 seconds, and FDG is the longest half-life tracer, 110 minutes. So that's the option.
Next. Which of the following is an advantage of prone imaging? A, decreased septal attenuation. B, decreased inferior wall attenuation. C, decreased imaging time, and D, less interference from liver and GI activity. Okay, overwhelmingly, that is the correct answer is B. Next. A 67-year-old woman with known coronary artery disease, status post PCI, 9 months ago, has the recurrence of chest pain, which is similar but not identical to that which prompted her PCI. If a SPECT MPI is ordered, the appropriate use criteria would consider this: A, appropriate, B, uncertain, C, inappropriate, D, not able to categorize. And the correct answer is A.
The key issue here is that she's symptomatic, and that is considered an appropriate application for SPECT imaging.
Next. Which of the following PET radiotracers is ideal for imaging myocardial blood flow? A, O15 water. B, C11 acetate. C, rubidium 82. And D, nitrogen 13 ammonia. And the correct answer is A, with good statistics on that. Next. A cardiac PET myocardioperfusion study may be the most appropriate which of the following individuals? A, 45-year-old woman with typical angina and equivocal rest exercise SPECT myocardial perfusion study. B, a 40-year-old female runner with atypical angina. C, a 55-year-old woman prior to thyroid surgery. And D, a 60-year-old obese woman, 580 pounds, with atypical angina. And the correct answer is A. Would you comment on those? Yes.
Absolutely. So A is the right answer. B is not right because in patients who are able to exercise, we should always consider exercise perfusion imaging as a first test. So whether it's an ETT treadmill alone or with imaging, that would be the option. Option D, I can see why some people picked it. This is something I did not cover. Most PET scanners have a table weight limit of about 500 to 550 pounds. So yes, PET is preferable for obese individuals, but once you get beyond 550 pounds, there are not many PET scanners that will fit the patient. So it's a practical reason why this patient could not undergo a PET scan.
Next. A 49-year-old man with a history of hypertension presents to his primary care physician for evaluation of sharp, non-exertional left-sided chest pain. His electrocardiogram reveals normal sinus rhythm and nonspecific T-wave flattening. His PCP calls you and asks if an exercise SPECT MPI should be scheduled. You tell him the following. A, per ACCF ASNIC criteria, the test is inappropriate and should not be scheduled. Per ACCF ASNIC criteria, the test is inappropriate, but if he wishes, the test may be done. C, per criteria, the test is appropriate, and if he wishes, the test may be scheduled. And D, as the overall risk of the patient is unclear, you advise that the test may be performed as per criteria, the appropriateness level is uncertain. The correct answer is A.
Okay, the answer is indeed A. The patient is able to exercise and has an interpretable electrocardiogram and sounds quite low risk. So overall, this would not be an appropriate indication. It should not be scheduled unless you would like to continue your practice, in which case you might consider doing it. I think that's more of a political decision, but the answer here is A. It is not an appropriate test, so by doing so, you're going to run into some issues down the road, and this might be one for counseling and suggesting alternative testing.
Next question. The earliest that either a technetium 99M tetraphosmin or tecsystemibi should be scanned following a rest injection is A, 15 minutes, B, 30 minutes, C, 45 minutes, D, 60 minutes. The correct answer is B. Robert, would you like to comment on the...
Sure. So it looks like the majority actually got this right. B is indeed the correct answer. Looking at the ASNIC guidelines, it does suggest waiting 30 to 45 minutes for tetraphosphamide and waiting 45 to 60 minutes for sestamibi. So the clearance is just a bit faster with tetraphosphamide. However, if we image before that, most likely there's going to be interference on the heart from a hot liver.
So those of you who answered C are sort of correct. Next question. Gating myocardial perfusion SPECT acquisitions allow for all of the following except A, assessment of regional wall motion and thickening, B, left ventricular ejection fraction calculation, C, right ventricular ejection fraction, And D, improved specificity by enabling identification of artifacts. Correct answer is C. I think those are good numbers. Next question. The imaging hallmark of a hibernating myocardium using PET perfusion and FDG imaging is A, decreased FDG with reduced blood flow, decreased FDG with normal blood flow, increased FDG uptake with normal blood flow, and increased FDG uptake with reduced blood flow. And the correct answer is D. Okay, next question. The preferred energy substrate for hibernating myocardium is A, glucose, B, free fatty acids, C, lactates, and D, ketones. Overwhelming statistics for the correct answer, A. Very good. Next. Which of the following is most important to review during post-acquisition quality control imaging? A, the linogram, B, the sinogram, C, the transaxial slices, and D, the cinema of projections. Is obviously referring to single photon SPECT imaging. Correct answer is D. Robert, you care to comment on those who answered B and C?
Sure. So D is the correct answer. By reviewing the CINE data, a lot of things can be evaluated, including motion artifact, the tracer distribution, attenuation patterns. Linograms and sinograms are good tools for evaluating motion, but they're only good for evaluating motion. The transaxial slices is not a bad answer, but the best answer is the cinema of the projections, just because so many things can be evaluated.
Next. Which of the following filters is always employed in a SPECT reconstruction using filtered back projection? A, ramp, B, non-point smoothing, C, a Hahn filter, D, Butterworth filter. Very good. The correct answer is A. Next. Myocardial viability assessment with FDG PET is typically performed in the glucose-loaded state, not fasting, because it improves glucose uptake in the A, hibernating myocardium, B, scarred myocardium, C, stunned myocardium, D, normal myocardium. Okay, the correct answer is D.
All right, so this deserves an explanation. As we discussed, hibernating myocardium uses glucose independent of whether it's fasting or postprandial state. That's because, remember, we discussed the step of beta oxidation is very sensitive to hypoxia. So these cells, whether or not the patient's fasting or fed, will always try to use glucose. The only cells that switch back and forth is the normal cells. So we give glucose and then give insulin to force the normal cells to start using glucose so that they could serve as a reference segment for comparison of uptake in the hibernating myocardial cells. Obviously, scarred myocardium will not take up FDG, and stunned myocardium also takes less FDG than usual. So that's the answer.
Next question. What are the compensatory metabolic switches that occur in myocardium after a transient ischemic episode? A, lactic acid and ketones become predominant fuels for ATP formation. B, switch from anaerobic fatty acid metabolism to aerobic glucose metabolism. C, normal fatty acid metabolism and increased glucose utilization. D, increased glucose utilization and decreased fatty metabolism. And the correct answer is D. Want to comment on the 14%?
Yeah. So I think most of you got it right. It's the same underlying phenomena as you would expect with hibernating myocardium, so it's hypoxia. So people sometimes refer to this as ischemic memory imaging, in that you could, for example, exercise a patient and then inject FDG during exercise. There have been some studies that did that. And myocardium that is ischemic will preferentially take up glucose or FDG, whereas the non-ischemic cells will still continue to use fatty acids. So this is a question based on imaging ischemic memory, and I realized it's not covered in the talk. So.
Next. A myocardial perfusion study using technetium-99m agent is acquired with a pulse height analyzer calibrated for thallium-201. Which of the following statements is correct regarding the imaging data? A, tomographic images should be reconstructed using the filter settings for thallium-201. B, the raw, unprocessed images should be evaluated with a final report indicating the study was suboptimal. C, the acquisition will need to be repeated using the correct pulse height analysis setting. And D, the raw data should be corrected using a thallium-201 uniformity correction map prior to reconstruction. And 79% of you got the correct answer, which is C. Next question. Increasing the cutoff frequency has what effect on myocardial perfusion imaging? Increases the noise. B, decreases the resolution. C, smooths the image. D, increases the count rate. Okay, the answers are all over the place. The correct answer is A.
All right, so remember with frequency, as we raise the critical frequency, we are doing the opposite. We're unsmoothing the images, making the images less smooth. There is therefore more noise in the images and better resolution. So as we lower the critical frequency, we are decreasing noise, we're decreasing the resolution, and we are taking out the noise.
Okay, so we have concluded the exam. In the final few minutes now, we have a number of questions that have been submitted to the panel. And I'll just start it off by reading some questions directed for Dr. Hendel. In the AUC guidelines, how do you define good functional capacity? Since the patient hasn't had an exercise study yet.
Good functional capacity per the AUC and per most standards is greater than 4 METs, which can be calibrated even though they're not doing a treadmill at that time based on activities of daily living. So, you know, someone who's able to walk a sufficient distance or up a few flight of stairs is deemed to be able to perform greater than 4 METs, and that would be considered good functional capacity.
Okay, another question for Dr. Hendel. If randomized clinical trials fail to demonstrate benefit of viability-guided approach, why should we do viability studies for asymptomatic low EF patients?
I can ask Sharmila to also comment on this too, but I think we have a trial now with Stitch that has sort of changed the paradigm, but a lot of people will tell you, and I am one of them also, that Stitch may not fit all players, and does this mean that we change the game in terms of ignoring the potential value of viability assessments in patient care? I don't think so. I think this was a very subjective and very biased population, and Stitch did not include all comers that were candidates for the trial. So I think, again, it's difficult to make practice-changing decisions on one trial that is not necessarily the without some flaws. There's certainly some wonderful meta-analyses that have been done and a lot of individual papers, some by Dr. DeCarli and Dr. Durbala, that clearly point that there is prognostic value in the assessment of myocardial viability, and I personally am not ready to change my practice habits.
Yes, I agree. I think the key to the question, I don't understand the question very well, but if it's an asymptomatic patient with LV dysfunction, the question is the patient truly asymptomatic? May not be having anginal symptoms, but does the patient have symptoms of heart failure? Sometimes patients with heart failure and very low ejection fraction may not be able to exercise enough to really provoke angina because they're limited by their dyspnea or shortness of breath. So that's something which may be somewhat difficult to distinguish. Regarding the Stitch trial, the way they analyzed the results obviously was their definition of viability was all cells that took up the radio tracer. So they didn't focus necessarily on the viability assessment like we talked about this afternoon, which was look at an area of perfusion deficit and see if that area is viable. Instead, what they did was they took the polar plots and they said how much of the polar plot is viable, how much of it has radiotracer uptake versus how much of it doesn't. So I think the analysis of the Stitch sub-study is slightly different from what was done with all the other previous studies, which focused on hibernation in the area of the perfusion deficit. So I agree with Dr. Hendel that I don't know if people are ready to make practice changes based on at least the published results so far. I think more sub-studies will be forthcoming.
Here's a question for the panel. How can I start reading PET if I was not trained in fellowship?
All right, so this is a very interesting question. The Society of Nuclear Medicine has published two papers in Journal of Nuclear Medicine. These papers refer to what are the criteria that an individual physician has to meet to be able to read PET imaging. And interestingly enough, I urge all of you that are interested to read up that journal, to read up that article. One of the things that comes up frequently with PET, especially with current day PET, is most devices are hybrid devices. And what do you do with CT interpretation? And most societies, including the SNM, I think is advocating that physicians who want to read hybrid scans, SPECT as well as PET, should have some training in CT interpretation. The numbers are given in the document. I don't remember, you need to read a certain number of PET cases, 125 or something like that, supervised under guidance of someone who does them routinely. So the numbers are all specified. I urge you to look it up. It can be done. I think the basic difference between SPECT and PET is the differences in technology. The underlying pathophysiology of coronary artery disease is the same. You really need to understand myocardial blood flow quantitation. You need to understand a little bit about the technique of coincidence detection. And the most important thing you need to understand is attenuation correction and artifacts related to that.
Another question, what do you do with only TID if the exercise is normal? How do you report it?
I'll take that one. That's a really challenging question. This seems to come up, I think, at every board review and most conferences that we attend. There's a lot of controversy here. Certainly in the presence of TID with regional perfusion defects that are transient, we know it's ischemic, and the presence of transient cavity enlargement portends a much worse prognosis and is correlated with severe and extensive disease. However, in the absence of perfusion defects, I think it gets a little bit more confounded. With exercise, there is an increased risk for subsequent complications and more extensive disease. However, with adenosine or vasodilator stress, there seems to be really almost no correlation whatsoever with those high-risk findings anatomically. So I think the question is interesting. Exercise TID with no perfusion defects, I guess I'd still be concerned about that as being balanced, even though I think that's a very infrequent finding. In the setting of vasodilator stress, I think it's very non-specific, and I would be reluctant to raise all the high-risk warnings.
Yeah, I fully agree with Dr. Hendel about that point. The only one other thing I wanted to add was sometimes patients with left ventricular hypertrophy may manifest TID without perfusion defects. And for some reason, it seems to be related more to subendocardial hypoperfusion in the setting of severe LVH without epicardial coronary disease. So frequently when I'm faced with that situation, I look at the ECG or look at the echo report to see if the patient has underlying left ventricular hypertrophy.
Okay, this is a technical question. Which is better for the evaluation of regional wall motion, 8 or 16 frames on a myocardial perfusion study? And a second part, how do we distinguish star artifact?
So the first part of that question about 8 versus 16 frames for regional wall motion, the answer would be 16 frames, because the more frames that you have, the better the temporal resolution. These benefits may be minimal, but it is better because of the better temporal resolution. The only caution in the other side of that always is the more frames you have, the less counts there are in each individual bin. So if it's a large patient, you know, with a low dose possibly being utilized for a one-day protocol, if it's having trouble tracking the myocardium when you're using 16 frames, you may want to consider using 8 frames just for better tracking of the myocardium. The second part of that, as far as a star artifact, is not something we're going to see on myocardial perfusion images. What that may be, you know, related to, or where the confusion may be, is a ramp artifact, which would be caused by, you know, removal of a star artifact with filtered back projection. And, you know, if there are decreased counts in the inferior wall, a couple of things that you could look at is there hot activity outside the heart at the same horizontal plane as the inferior wall of the heart? And the other would be to look at the raw projection data. If this is normal study, it's probably, you know, you're going to be able to see that inferior wall looking possibly normal on the projection data, but decreased counts on the process data because it is due to a reconstruction artifact.
This is more of a request than a question, but it's a request to review some slides on page 378 with the audience response equipment, and we'll do that in the case reviews later on today. I believe Dr. Dorbola has a couple of questions that have been submitted.
Sure. I have a few questions about the FDG session. One question is, patient with new diagnosis of cardiomyopathy, no anginal symptoms, normal myocardial perfusion stress test, question, need for catheterization. I don't think there's a definitive answer for that. Yet, if you look at the guidelines, the heart failure group would still advocate to perform some form of coronary angiography a one time in all patients with cardiomyopathy. That's the practice. There's no definite regulation on how to do it. Having said that, what would you do? If the patient is relatively young, we would prefer to do a CT coronary angiogram to document that in the context of LV dysfunction, there's no coronary disease. And the only reason for doing that is to eliminate the very small possibility that it could be true balanced ischemia. However, what I discussed earlier still stands, which is a normal myocardial perfusion study has an extremely high specificity to exclude underlying ischemic cardiomyopathy.
Sharmila, just to add to that, I think we do have, you know, a number of papers that were published a few years ago in SPECT that suggested that it could be used and as a surrogate, and that not everyone needed angiography. I think the ASNIC meeting on an annual basis has this question as a debate, and we get both viewpoints expressed as there's literature both directions.
Question for Dr. Hendel. How will EMR/POE be assessed and used by CMS to adjust individual physician global MPI payments? Will EMRs generate an audit trail that CMS will use to deny payments using AUC?
I think someone's giving us a lot more of a vision than we have. I have no idea what CMS is going to do. Certainly EHRs will permit a lot of data mining, but again, it's a claims-based data setup, so you're going to be missing a lot of clinical information and a lot of challenges in terms of really defining some aspects of appropriate use, and how it's being defined for payment schemes I don't think has even been addressed. There are a number of projects, including a CMS innovation project looking at innovative ways for reimbursement that are currently out there for comments and things, but I don't think we have any idea. Certainly, I think actually CMS is probably several years ahead of some of the private industry, which is interesting that they're certainly going to be collecting information. We are getting some good feedback, but I'm not sure we're going to be able to bore down that close.
Dorbala?
All right, so the next question is from the first talk this morning. I understand that myocardial uptake of technetium is later in rest injection, i.e. liver uptake is higher than cardiac 20 minutes post-rest injection. So question, so why do we give sublingual nitroglycerin before rest injection, although we all know that nitroglycerin sublingual has a short half-life, few minutes? It's a very interesting question. So it's important to understand specifically what exactly happens. So we give sublingual nitroglycerin followed by radiotracer injection within the next 5 minutes. Remember, nitroglycerin starts acting right away. The vasodilation remains for about 5 to 10 minutes or whatever. Technetium, once injected intravenously, gets into the myocytes within the first 1 to 2 minutes after injection. So the goal of giving nitroglycerin is to maintain hyperemia or coronary vasodilation at the time technetium is injected, because that's when it goes into the myocytes. The reason for imaging the patient half an hour or 45 minutes later is to avoid interference from the hepatic uptake. But it's very important to keep in your mind the distinction between the two. The radiotracer uptake into the myocytes is at the time of injection within the first 1 to 2 minutes. That's exactly the reason why when you inject patient on a treadmill, you inject technetium and continue exercise for 1 to 2 minutes, because you want to maintain hyperemic myocardial blood flow and enable radiotracer uptake during maximal hyperemia. Imaging later is to avoid artifacts from liver. All right?
Question for Dr. Hendel. Where does a patient with a history of silent ischemia or a prior event without preceding symptoms and subsequent revascularization fit in the follow-up imaging guideline?
It's a great question. The issue is whether or not they had symptoms before revascularization, and if they did not, then how do you gauge what's going on and how can you follow the patient? The 2005 radionuclide appropriateness criteria did address that and found actually no difference in categorization, because there was really no literature-based explanations of why there should be a difference. The 2009 criteria actually removed the separation of whether they were symptomatic before or asymptomatic before revascularization. So while clinically I agree with the person who asked the question that it is a concern and a question, there's really no data and no basis for this. So yes, the fear is that perhaps since they had no symptoms and no way to track whether or not they had ongoing ischemia, that indeed maybe you should do more closer scrutiny. However, again, that's not supported by literature, and a panel of experts or supposed experts or whatever decided that that wasn't criteria. So therefore, whether they're symptomatic or not doesn't matter.
Okay, I'll read one more question for Dr. Hendel. I know some of you have submitted a few extra for Dr. Dorbala. We'll hold those for the next session, trying to get back on time here. How do we balance atypical symptoms and increasing coronary risk in women with the appropriate/inappropriate criteria?
Well, it still is a matter of categorization, and I think there's a number of papers coming out, one this week by Dr. Shaw in Circulation, that do address some of these issues. Certainly women have risks. We can define the risks for the most part. They may be different, and again, appropriate use criteria and guidelines will accept whatever methodology you're creating. There is no gender distinction in the criteria themselves because, again, some of the risk categorization is based on gender, age, and description of chest pain a la Diamond and Forrester many years ago. I think we need to rethink that a little bit, but for the most part, we are seeing higher inappropriate rates, but the question is, how does that translate to outcomes? And I think we're now starting to see it doesn't. So the fear that we are perhaps labeling some of the women's studies as inappropriate and yet they should be done, right now doesn't have any documentation in the literature. This is obviously something we're going to be tracking, and I know there's a number of presentations, and there was a paper just published in JACC Imaging this morning by Dr. Vitola's lab and some of the Brazilian investigators that suggest that there's a lot of prognostic value. So I think it's a work in progress, but again, risk is inherent in the categorizations of the appropriate use, and whether you're a man or a woman or old or young or diabetic or not, that helps to formulate whether or not you're low, intermediate, or high risk.